Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 228, featuring Phil Miller, our Vice President of Product Management, and Simeon Balabanov, who is our Product Manager for V-Ray for Unreal. I recorded this podcast in Sofia just before Total Chaos. I sat down with the guys in the office and decided that we should do a podcast about some of the cool stuff that's going on and some of the amazing work that's happening, obviously, in V-Ray for Unreal. But we actually cover a whole lot of subjects in here. It's a very techie podcast for those of you who like that kind of stuff. We talk, obviously, about V-Ray for Unreal, what's that, where that's going, what it's about, why our customers want it, and all that stuff. But we also talk about understanding the difference between rasterize and ray tracing, down to some fundamental stuff that we should know, especially in terms of workflow. We also talk about, you know, sort of a definition of what real time is, which obviously brings us to the subject of Lavina and what Lavina is all about. So we get to talk about that. Some of the other subjects we end up covering here is the pain of dealing with UVs and how necessary that is in certain real-time worlds and not necessarily as necessary in a ray tracing world. We also talk about VR and how VR is an integral part of why our customers are interested in real-time. But another big subject that I'm sure a lot of you guys are interested in is we talk about RT cores and how RT cores contribute to ray tracing. What exactly do they do? Where can they be taken advantage of? And a bunch of those other things. And Phil is a big expert in this area, so it's really great to have him on. I don't really have any announcements because I am recording this intro way in advance of when this podcast is coming out because I am going on a well-deserved vacation. So I'm actually just prepping these shows ahead of time. So if there's some amazing announcement that happened while I was on vacation, I don't know about it yet because it hasn't happened to me when I recorded this. But either way, I think you will still find that this amazing podcast is still very relevant today about talking about our future, even though I recorded this in the past. All right, without further ado, please enjoy this fantastic podcast with Phil and Simeon.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Let's talk about, first of all, the what real time means nowadays. Because real time rendering was always sort of a game world type thing or a viewport type thing, but not something that you consider for presentations that much, right? What do you think, Phil?
As the game engines got higher and higher quality, you started seeing like, hey, I can stay in the game engine and actually present.
Right.
But originally, no. But it still is. It still comes with the challenge that to get it to that quality takes a lot of work.
Right. Yes. But okay. All right. So let's go back a little bit before in history. There's two kinds of renderings that existed in the world, right? When we were thinking about rendering, 20, 30 years ago. So there was something called rasterized rendering and something called ray tracing. Mm-hmm. Right, so these two types of renderings represented, you know, different ways to represent the 3D world in some fashion. Now, ray tracing is based on tracing rays that look out into the world and that basically intersect with geometry and represent the light and the cameras and how they interact with the world. Rasterized rendering, but the problem with that rendering, when you look back many, many years ago, is very slow. It took a long time to do. You know, back in the 80s, when they would do some ray tracing demos, it'd be like a whole day to render a sphere on a checkered plane, right? But then there was something called rasterized rendering. So why don't you explain what rasterized rendering is as opposed to ray tracing?
A technical description?
Well, layman's description.
Well, thrust-rise rendering, you're looking at the coverage of the triangle, I mean, the coverage the triangle has on the pixels.
Right.
And you're really kind of buffering what the scene has as viewed from the camera.
Right.
And you're rejecting things that it doesn't have. And it's very fast, mainly because you have specialized hardware called GPUs that were designed specifically to handle that exact task.
Right.
When rasterization started out, you know, back in the 80s, mm-hmm. It was being done entirely on the CPU, mm-hmm. and while faster than ray tracing, it was still not real time.
Right.
Once GPUs became in existence, then game engines and what you see as real time became possible.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really that marriage of both the technique as well as having hardware designed for it.
Right. But there's a lot of things that rasterization doesn't do that ray tracing does.
Oh yeah, it's basically all designed for speed, and you have there are many compromises from the very beginning. So to begin with, you can't trace a ray. So everything dealing with reflections or lighting is entirely in old CG tricks in, of the trade,
right,
of how to do things. So you have reflection maps, later on we've got cubic maps, automatic cubic maps for reflections. For simulating light, often you have, light does not bounce in a rasterized engine, so what that means is that you have to have lights below the floor to light up the ceiling. Mm-hmm. You have to have vampire lights to suck light out of corners to make them darker.
Right.
You have to start adding new techniques later on when they had more computation, like ambient occlusion, to try to fake lighting in corners, shading.
Mm-hmm.
And it just becomes this layering and layering of tricks in order to make it look real. But all those tricks come really with talent. The person has to know how to put them in, and while you can get a scene to look really good, it'll only look good for that one environment. And as soon as you move, perhaps, say, a photorealistic car to another environment, you have to start all over.
Yeah.
Because all those reflections, all that lighting was baked, and now you have to put it all in again.
Right.
So now that's okay for a game title, because the game title is fixed.
Right.
Right? I mean, you design it for that environment and that situation that the game has, or that game level has, and it's always going to be the same, and it's always going to look good.
Right.
But if you are bringing in your own content, your own design, say, then you're having to basically build a game every time.
Right.
And, or a game level every time. And that's expensive.
So the other example that I use, is when I was, doing visual effects, and they were still using, this is how old I am, they were still using rasterized rendering during visual effects in the old days,
mm-hmm.
like such as RenderMan with Ray stuff,
mm-hmm.
Is that if you were going to do a movie, you would look at how many shots you had to light, and you could only budget about 20 shots per lighter, because that's how long it took for each scene to be lit correctly. It takes a long time. You have to fake all the lights, you have to fake all the shaders, you have to fake all of the stuff to make it look correct.
Mm-hmm.
When you suddenly move to fully ray trace rendering, suddenly that budget went way up. Like one lighter could light 100, 120 shots easily, or more, because
right.
you don't have to fake anything.
And more importantly, that lighter can think about how light is acting in the real world. He gets
right.
to think like a photographer or a gaffer, and right. not a CG magician.
Right.
One good example is that Pixar showed one time was a scene from Toy Story 3, which had over 300 lights to light, was a basic scene. When they switched that over to global illumination with ray tracing,
mm-hmm.
They had 6 lights plus the sun.
Right.
So take your choice. Set up 300 lights or set up 6.
Right. I know. I feel very much sympathetic about that. Now, what's happened, fast forward, is that question suddenly has come up again. Like the choices between rasterized rendering and ray tracing, right?
And so Simeon is very familiar with this because he speaks to a lot of our customers that are sort of exploring the real-time world that is still in the rasterized world, right, in a lot of ways. But they are sort of going into the real-time world. So tell me a little bit about the different customers, the non-video game people that you're talking to, and how they're suddenly saying, I'm interested in this technology. Where can I go from here? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, we do have a different transition expertise required because typically we have somewhat the reverse process. The majority of the customers that I've been dealing with are actually already using V-Ray as their main ray tracing engine, and they're kind of switching this process, reversing this process,
right.
So going into the rasterizing engine, and it all comes down to sacrificing quality, of course.
Right.
As Phil mentioned earlier, if I can make an overview of the whole thing, of the whole processes, mm-hmm. is that you're actually changing or trading artist time for computer time, and using the different techniques.
Right.
And ray tracing has become the choice of the many studios because they can afford computer time. And they can safely throw a couple of renders, 100 or thousands of renders on the render farm,
right?
And set up everything physically correct based on physical on photographic principles and so
right.
on. And it's only natural for these artists to experience to struggle when they have to go into a rasterizing engine because they have to start I don't want to say cheating, but cutting corners again.
Right.
Switching for shadow maps, reflection environments, reflection maps, and so mm-hmm. on and so forth. And hybrid, blending those two effects or these effects, creating this type of hybrid rendering.
Right.
With all the screen space reflections, mixing with the spherical reflection captures or box reflection captures.
Right.
And you have to manually place affecting helpers all around the scene, which all of this cannot be automated. It has to be artists done by hand.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, of course, not only artistic, but also technically challenging thing to do.
Right.
And
so you can't just to be clear, mm-hmm. right? So let's say you're an artist. And by the way, let's just keep clear. What kind of artists are we talking about? We're talking about architecture people and people that are doing design work. That's like the big popular stuff right now.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So okay. So you have architect, not people necessarily designing games or even people in visual effects, but more people that are focused on creating visualization techniques and want to have a real-time experience of that visualization.
Yes,
right?
Mainly.
So those artists for years and years and years have been trained to use V-Ray or another ray tracer if they want to, but a lot of them use V-Ray.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically say, okay, I want to go into this, but I have all my assets in V-Ray and I get them into this system. Suddenly, all of their techniques, specifically lighting techniques, mm-hmm. they have to start all over again in a lot of ways.
Well, not necessarily all over, but yes, to a large percentage.
You don't just say, okay, now I have an asset in my real-time engine, let's say Unreal,
mm-hmm.
and say, it just works. It doesn't. It
yeah.
doesn't look even close to what you had before, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, we need to talk about, I believe there are three concepts here. And the first, I will flash back to the beginning of the conversation,
right.
What's real time?
Right.
And because it's subjective, I feel like I should throw a couple of clarifications.
Let's do it.
Yes, yeah. Real time, to me, it seems like just, technically speaking, is just the speed at which the renders come
can
to the
be,
screen.
Right.
Yeah. And in nowadays, I believe that the threshold would be more than 30 frames per second. Of course, with the introduction of VR, these frame rates jump quite higher.
To 90.
Yeah, to 90. Yes,
right.
Exactly. So if you can output at least, let's say, 90 frames per second, then you can consider this VR-enabled real-time renderer.
Right.
But nobody talks about quality, and you can Let's keep that. But you can do ray tracing with this frame rate, although it will be quite noisy because of the lack of samples taken per sample, per pixel, and so on. Mm. So it's very subjective. But let's say that if the quality is acceptable and you can deliver more than 30, 60, 90 frames per second, mm-hmm. this we can consider real-time render.
Right.
Doesn't matter what type of cutting corners and techniques you're utilizing to do that.
Yes.
There are numerous techniques that can be utilized by upscaling, denoising, and removing ray tracing altogether, and so on.
Well, we'll get to the ray tracing part a little
yes,
later.
Yes. Yeah. I'm just so. If this is considered real time, mm-hmm. Then this is your goal. You need to make the render output that many frames per second.
Right.
To make it within the threshold.
Right.
And here starts the corner cutting.
Right. Because before you could say, I'll just make it as high quality as I want and then I'll just wait for the render.
Exactly.
So now you say, no, my render has to be this speed. So mm-hmm, in order mm-hmm. to do that, I gotta remove, right?
Which is exactly what a game artist does.
Right.
They have
polygon budgets, they have texture size budgets,
and they're constantly looking at their FPS and seeing how much they can add before it drops.
Right.
So when talking in the context of a gaming world, then mm-hmm. there is one other thing, and that's interactivity, mm-hmm. because people tend to go into game engines or real time engines for the faster interaction. Nobody goes there to get the 60 frames per second and just to look around or walk around. This could have been achieved with a regular spherical environment and just look around and switch. In VR, these are common techniques.
Right.
However, people usually want to move stuff, change lighting, and open doors, go through elevators and stuff like that.
Right.
And here comes the important part, and this is dynamics or interaction in the levels, mm-hmm. in the games, in the engine itself. So it all depends also on how much interactivity can afford, because. To make lighting and movable objects dynamic mm-hmm. and to respond correctly with light in your levels, mm-hmm. You need to reevaluate them for every second, for every light, for every second. Basically, you need to do almost ray tracing in real time.
Right.
And because this is expensive, this impedes your frame rate and basically kills it. Mm-hmm. So any additional feature added to this, any additional dynamic feature actually costs you a lot.
Right.
And the common technique, which is valid even now. Is to try to cache pre-compute as many of the calculations as possible.
Right.
And now we come to the really very, very familiar topic with any gaming artist, and which is called light baking the light mapping, which is a fancy way to just store the illumination of your scene in simple textures. And you can, in layman's terms, use these maps. Mm-hmm. They're called light maps, as let's say self-illuminated shaders.
Right.
This makes them static, so meaning that you can't interact with them, you can't change these guys, these are just pre-calculated textures, but they give you...
they can give you very good lighting.
They give you really good lighting, and they also don't... require calculations. These are just simple texture call.
But that process of baking the lighting can take some time.
Yes, and here's the tricky part.
Right.
It not only takes some time, machine time, mm-hmm. by because the higher the quality of the light map, the longer you need to render it.
Right.
But the drawback here is also that it takes a lot of pre-data prep or preparation for the assets. Because being textures, they need to be using some UVs, and you need to make UVs in such a way that you can't reuse UV space, meaning that
nothing overlaps
exactly.
Right.
And you can't stretch UVs because you have to utilize the texture space as
they
much
have
as
to
possible.
Be at real time scales. Yep.
Yeah. And unfortunately, because due to optimization techniques such as load, mipmaps, mm-hmm. LODs, and stuff mm-hmm. like that, you need to make sure that there is a decent amount of padding between the UVs, mm-hmm. or as less UV seams as possible.
Right.
Which essentially means that an artist has to unwrap every single model in your scene
manually. You can't just do auto unwrap. Yes. It's not, well, you can, but it won't look good, right?
Yeah, and then it also helps if the UV tiling is fairly uniform across the scene.
Right.
So a UV space is pretty consistent between all the objects.
Right.
And artists aren't used to that because usually you make up. The tiling is one thing for an object, and you make it up in the tiling parameters for the material on that object. Mm-hmm. Well, you don't do that in light baking. In light baking, everything's uniform. And,
right. Yeah.
And you're going to get different lighting results if everything isn't uniform. So
right.
That is a big education process as well as a tedious process.
Right. Right. Designing a game level is not fast.
No.
Right?
No.
And so suddenly you're taking designers who are used to just designing their space, not thinking about some of those concepts, and are used to getting beautiful photorealistic images mm-hmm. at the cost of render time.
Yep.
Now suddenly they have to do a lot more technical work and develop a lot more knowledge and spend a lot of artist time in order to get to that level, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when people see light baking, they immediately want it. They're like, that's it. That's exactly what I want. That lighting looks right.
Right.
And I don't have to put in all those extra lights I was talking about before.
Yeah, because it's all baked in.
It's all baked in.
So you could, but so just to be clear, just so people know, like you can use ray tracing lighting techniques, bake it in.
Yes.
And then rasterize it. Right?
Yep,
so
correct.
Global illumination can be baked in
right.
to your lighting.
Mm-hmm,
so
yep.
you can go back and so it's like, I know how to do this in Vray because this is how it's worked properly so I can have proper window lighting coming in, proper light bouncing, colors, bleeding, all of that mm-hmm. stuff, all the shadows, all the ambient occlusion, not ambient occlusion, but the what looks like ambient occlusion is mm-hmm. all baked in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a ray tracing portion. So you can imagine you're like, you got to ray trace the entire room, every surface. Bake that as a texture, and then in real time it'll look good. Now the problem is, as you mentioned, if I move this table, everything's broken.
Or move exactly. a light.
Or move a light, everything's
yeah,
broken.
Change position of the sun,
yeah.
nothing works.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So those are, they look good for one situation, which mm-hmm. may be fine, but in case you want some more interactivity,
yeah.
you're gonna lose that opportunity.
Right? Well, yeah, there are techniques where you can bake several lighting scenarios, for example,
mm-hmm.
And you can blend between the two, but remember that these are textures that need to be loaded on the GPU. So
right. So now you
it
have
quickly
two,
becomes
two sets of textures you have to load.
Yep.
Right.
Which are not small.
Not small.
You're covering the whole level, and yeah.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about GPU since you brought it up. So you mentioned the fact that now we have a budget. A budget is how many frames per second you have to do, right? So there's several ways you can do this. One, you can continue to cut down on how much stuff you put in there. Or the other one is you can get faster and faster hardware that can handle that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So at which point you basically say, okay, I want a bigger GPU, bigger GPU. And some there's some really monster GPUs out there that can do amazing amount of stuff. The problem is they're very expensive and not everyone has them. Right?
Yep.
So your real-time experience now gets shut down to like only if you use this computer with this GPU will you be able to experience this correctly. You can't just say it's real-time and you can see it on your phone, right? Because your
no.
phone doesn't have a powerful GPU, right? Am I right?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Or even to your laptop.
Or even to your laptop,
yeah.
right. So.
Yeah. But again, I feel I should say that this quickly becomes subjective again.
Okay.
Because the quality is subjective, and depending on what type of quality a user agrees is acceptable.
Okay.
You know, because you can quickly do just a, let's say if you're going for mobile, you can do light baking.
Sure.
You can keep the texture sizes smaller
mm-hmm.
and forget about interactive lighting. Just make everything static. So this could theoretically work on a mobile phone.
But you okay? Yes, but you have to make those decisions along the way.
Absolutely.
Right. So there is some really okay. There's very interesting ideas to think about. Like you know, how am I going to budget this when you're planning on it? Just saying I'm going to make something interactive mm-hmm. is a big plan of like interactive where, interactive how.
Right. Your target platform.
Right.
Yeah.
How low a hardware you're willing to use?
It's a pipeline decision.
Yeah.
And people spent years making their pipelines.
Right.
Coming up with a proper pipeline.
Right. Now, since you talked to a lot of our customers, how have they reacted to like sort of making that jump? And when did they come to you as like, you know, because I know some of them came to me as like, we need your help on this. So tell us a little bit about how the customers looked at this and how they wanted your help on this.
Right. Well, it's an interesting subject. The first reactions that we got was immediately, we want this. We want real time. We want this quality. And the first is we want real time. Mm-hmm. Then they say, okay, but real time doesn't look good. We want the V-Ray quality and we want it real time.
Right.
And that became the challenge because as we just discussed, our typical customers are not used to this type of workflow. Mm-hmm. So there are many legacy education that they needed to know.
Right.
And then we started discussing with each and everyone why game engines or rasterizers are fast. Well, basically what we're currently discussing,
yeah.
But we did that with every customer.
Right.
The bottom line was that they needed to change their pipeline.
Okay.
They needed to think about what their goal is,
mm-hmm.
Set it up correctly, find the appropriate people or appropriate artist or teach them how to do these new steps in their pipeline, decide which pipelines which steps are needed exactly, because for example there are people that we have customers that are perfectly okay with using automatic unwraps. Just whatever the algorithm does,
mm-hmm.
it kind of works for them. They were of course not utilizing the texture space, but if you're using smaller projects, you can afford to increase the size of textures, waste texture space,
mm-hmm.
Because if, for example, you're doing only a single room,
mm-hmm.
With a couple of objects in there, it will fit on practically any GPU.
Okay.
Of course, when the size, the scale becomes larger, you need to start thinking about optimizations, mm. and unfortunately, these processes are really difficult to implement in a pipeline, just because you have to go manual and
right.
you have to swap machine time for artist time.
Right.
And this was actually, I feel, the most painful part.
I can imagine, because I don't think that architects or, you know, ArcVis people are used to wrapping and unwrapping and stitching UVs together. That's
everybody hates that.
Yeah, yeah. Or things that didn't need mapping coordinates before because they were using procedurals.
Right.
Like they were, you know, suddenly now needing mapping coordinates.
Right.
And it's like a...
You can't just triplanar something and it looks good. No. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, even if you do a triplanar, it would work for the material, but not for the light
not
baking.
Not for the lighting baking, right. Yeah, you can't triplanar light baking. I mean, I remember... This was my first job in visual effects. Literally was, you know, to work. I was working on Day After Tomorrow and I was doing all the buildings for all of New York. And I would spend about a day modeling a building or less,
mm-hmm.
and about 3 or 4 days UV wrapping the building.
There you go.
Yeah. And that was, and he was thinking, it's like, that's ridiculous. Like, he's like, yeah, I can build a building really fast. It's the textures that are a pain in the butt. And that's something that there are people who have to do suddenly, you know?
Yeah. Every time, every day, and another interesting fact is that the people coming from gaming background and experience with game engines don't complain about that. It's their workflow. They know how
they've been
do
used
this.
To doing it for so long.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, and this kind of gets ignored by the people who want to go into by non-gaming artists, mm-hmm. who want to go into real time.
Right.
They just kind of they never had to deal with unwrapping that intensively because there are procedurals and triplanar mapping,
right.
and this stuff. While the game artists are used to that, so they don't talk about it. And there was this huge gap of misinformation,
right.
Or of information that nobody talks about because it's a I can understand why there is no automatic solution. It's a painful process. Nobody wants to do it,
right.
But nobody talks about it. And this doesn't solve the problem, actually.
Right.
It makes it a little bit worse because people looking at all these architectural demos in real time think that this is awesome and they can get this quality and there are no hidden
you're saying this is a lie, there is no cake, right?
yes and suddenly you're facing this challenge that you have never had to face.
You can, again, let's go back to what we're saying, you can make rasterized rendering look absolutely gorgeous, you just don't realize how long it takes to get there. Right.
That's right.
And so there are tons of demos of beautiful real-time rendered stuff. Mm-hmm. You just don't realize it may have taken a month or more and several artists to make it look that good.
There is no counter for the amount of work that went into, into it.
Always beware of the demo.
Yeah. And by the way, people's time is way more expensive than computer time.
Yeah.
So, but at the same time, you still have a goal to make something look good. So let's talk a little bit. I want to get into the real-time ray tracing stuff. We'll get there.
Sure.
But I want to talk about something that people have been, a word that's been going around called good enough.
Oh, yes. I wish I put a trademark on that the first time I heard it a few years ago.
Right. So explain what that means, there's a lot of people out there saying it's not pretty, but it's good enough.
Yeah. Well, we come back to this thing I mentioned earlier because it has to do with the quality and the purpose of the visualization.
Right.
And both of these things are subjective or actually variable.
Mm-hmm.
The quality is subjective. The purpose is quite different depending on the project.
Right.
I've had talks with customers that wanted just to do space explorations in VR.
Right.
So they didn't care about materials, they didn't care about the detail of a bump or, you know, a displacement or anything. They just wanted to see how the shadow was cast inside of a building, and they wanted to make sure that when they put the VR goggles and put it into scale, you know, in a human scale, let's say the corridor is wide enough for two people to go in side by side, or the staircase or the doors are tall enough to fit that.
Mm-hmm.
So they were doing the space explorations there. So for them, the quality wouldn't be a factor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they just want to have some decent representation of lighting, and nothing else.
Right.
And also, then again, first of all, they need physical accurateness for the lighting, but not physical accurateness for materials. They just throw in a grayscale material there. Make the windows transparent, and just observe how lighting is there.
Yeah,
and this is good enough for them.
Right.
Actually, perfect.
Right.
So this is a good example of.
Yeah, you touched on one thing though. That you mentioned VR and getting that experience, and I think that's the number one reason why designers are wanting to go to real time these days.
Right.
Because,
I mean, you can do VR with really beautiful V-Ray renders now with, you know, a cube mass, but you don't get 6 degrees of freedom.
You don't get to move, right?
Right.
I mean, yeah, it's one thing to have sphericals that you can, and that's very valuable.
Yeah.
But it's another thing to be able to move.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, once they get a taste of one, they want the other too.
Sure.
And for a designer, having that feel of one-to-one scale is revolutionary because in all of the, you know, centuries of visualization, it's always been a 2D picture.
Right.
And a lot of people can't relate to a 2D picture. And, you know, there's perspective and forced and you know, what does it really look like? And where's my eye level at? And you don't feel like you're there.
Right.
In VR, you do, and you get a real sense of the space.
So you think that the architecture world really, like, their biggest motivation to do real-time was VR?
It is, yes.
Do you agree? I constantly
hear that.
To many of our customers, yes.
That's it. It's about VR, right?
Yeah.
It's not just about creating an interactive experience that you can see on a screen.
Nope.
It's about the VR experience, right?
Because that's the game changer. That allows them to experience and actually have their clients experience the design at one-to-one scale like they never could before.
Right.
So it's for them. It's not VR is not a gimmick. It's
right.
A, it's a real
value.
No.
I know that. I mean, I have countless podcasts about the importance of VR and architecture, but it's, I'm just talking about the motivation, right? The motivation of real time was VR, which makes sense if you think about it. But now, again, that greatly affects your budget because you have to be at 90 frames a second in this experience.
Exactly. And then getting back to your point of good enough.
Right.
The reason you're trying to experience that space is, especially if you're in architecture, you want to see the lighting. So now you're back to the whole light baking thing again, mm-hmm. because the game lighting isn't going to be sufficient.
No.
So if you're only caring about massing and feeling what the space feels like,
right.
you don't have to go through the light baking thing. You can do it all with a monochromatic model,
right?
Or a crappily material model, whatever. Right. But as soon as you really want to experience your space, if you're like doing a Louis Kahn mm-hmm. model, mm-hmm. you wouldn't do that without light baking.
No. Yeah, of course.
Then we're back to all the work.
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay, so now you have customers and they've come to us and they say, how do I take what I've already know how to do mm-hmm. in V-Ray and I want to bring it into Cinch'n? And our first thing for them was like, translation, right?
Yeah. Again, because they were new to this world, mm-hmm. For them, it felt like they have to redo all their projects again.
Yes,
once
which
again.
They did.
Which is partly true. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. And while this was not very very problematic for people coming from the gaming industry, mm-hmm. they had to do it either way because they did the optimizations inside of the engine, LODs and mipmaps and so on. This was kind of a additional step for every VR user, mm-hmm. and they kind of felt like they needed to do double work.
So in their
mind, of course, they have already done the models, they have done the shading, the lighting, and it was just a matter of kind of interpreting or translating those into a different type of environment, different mm-hmm. type of rendering. So the first question was, isn't there a way that does this automatically mm-hmm. For us? And the short answer is yes, but would it be good enough for you?
Right.
and because of the usage of procedurals and triplanar maps and not caring about the UVs, mm-hmm. you could transfer the shaders there, just the shaders. Mm-hmm. But then again, if you want to get the good quality, you need to light bake. Hence, your models wouldn't work if you translate them just one-to-one.
Right.
Additional factor to this was that shaders are shaders. They have to be evaluated. And mm-hmm. when you're evaluating them 90 frames per second, this mm-hmm. means that you need to do 90 times more calculations for every shader. Mm-hmm. So complex shaders are multiplying the cost of rendering 90
right.
times
right.
More. So it's very efficient for you to optimize the shaders as well.
Right.
Bake down multiple maps into one.
Right.
Not use layered textures, layered materials as yep. much as possible, because all of these are just separate calculations. And while, for example, a more complex shader on an average rendering in V-Ray, let's say that takes about an hour. If all the shaders in your scene may add, I don't know, 5 to 10 minutes, mm-hmm. it's just a small percentage of the whole rendering time. Mm-hmm. If you remove the rendering part, sorry, the rest of it is lighting, mm-hmm. is ray tracing for lighting. Mm-hmm. If you remove that, you're still left with this 5 to 10 minutes of complex shaders.
Which is still way too much for real time.
Yes, and you can't use this directly in real time. Even
right.
if you approximate it a little bit, yeah. it's still thousands of calculations per shader that need to happen 90 frames per second, 90 times per second. So this was again a no-go, and that was yet another aspect that our customers had to optimize and change in their pipeline. This posed a really interesting challenge for us to make a decision. do we transfer the materials one to one so that for the sake of parity,
mm-hmm.
so that the Vray user gets exactly what they had in their 3ds Max scene or in SketchUp yeah. scene in Unreal?
Or do we try to optimize the shaders?
Yes, yes. Right. Because who would want to have a 1 frames per second project?
Right. Yeah.
Even if it looks almost the same in 3ds Max,
right.
it's just not the purpose.
Right.
For the whole migration process. So there we need to make some change. Decisions and changes,
mm-hmm.
And at that time we made the decision to optimize.
Okay.
But optimization means loss of parity and loss of visual parity between the two. You,
right.
you always have to cut corners,
right.
to change some things. The biggest example of this would be, for example, blend materials. Blended materials in V-Ray are rendered layer per layer.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on the different BRDFs, they are evaluated differently,
mm-hmm.
and I should say properly, physically mm-hmm. properly, and then the combined result of the two materials is combined in the end, is
mm-hmm.
displayed.
Mm-hmm.
While in Unreal you can't afford to shade twice, you have to shrink down everything to a simple material and only afford one draw call per material.
Right.
And this obviously poses difference in materials. For example, every time you have more complex materials such as pearlescent materials, flip-flop, car paints were the biggest example, mm-hmm. or any GGX materials with different types of blending. I still remember there are still people using the Grant Warwick tutorials where they blend materials with different glossiness values with different color correction curves,
mm-hmm.
Which makes really pretty materials, but you can never get this in real time.
Right.
So these were all challenges that we needed to solve for our customers.
Okay. Go ahead. I want to fast forward a little bit to ray tracing now. So what's happened recently is in the world of ray tracing started to come into this thing to solve some of that, saying, hey, now we have new technology, now we have some new hardware, now we have some new APIs, new things that are basically allowing us to look at ray tracing in real time,
mm-hmm.
right? And then when we look at that idea, yes, you need some pretty robust new hardware to make that work, but suddenly that good enough, meaning like, hey, maybe we can up the quality. Maybe I don't have to bake all of these, reflection maps in there. Maybe I can get some better GI or do something of this nature, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that started to come into play. And we looked into that ourselves, and we decided to see, well, what can we do with our knowledge of ray tracing to look at the real-time world? And that's when we sort of, experiment or working with this Project Lavina, which is a real-time ray tracing. Now, there's something that's basically fundamentally different, because there's a lot of things out there that you're looking at that's called real-time ray tracing that's not exactly what what you say it is, right? So when we looked at Lavina, mm-hmm. we looked at the same concept of ray tracing that we use for V-Ray, meaning that we fully ray trace the scene. We look at
right.
everything and we ray trace everything,
yeah.
right?
Right.
And that is fundamentally different from what people are seeing out there that is called real-time ray tracing.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because the real-time, what you're talking about in the game engines, those are ray tracing effects.
Ray tracing effects.
Right, which are actually merged with the standard raster rendering of the game engine.
Right.
And now you have the joy of dealing with both your standard rasterization budget for your target FPS,
mm-hmm.
As well as now having a ray tracing budget.
Right.
So there are there's several effects that can be added, like ray traced ambient occlusion, shadows,
reflections,
and GI.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty hard to get all of them to work at the same time, or
mm-hmm.
all of them to work, or any of them to work with a lot of bounces.
Right.
Because they're expensive.
Right.
Even with this new dedicated hardware, you're still processing a full game engine at the same time.
Right. So all the problems you had before...
Are still there. Yep.
So you still have to deal with light baking if you can. you still have to deal with...
Right, because the GI they do have is usually only one or two bounces, and that's not sufficient for...
Like an interior scene or something. Mm-hmm.
Right. No, yeah, an architect would like, well, where's the rest of it?
Right. Yeah.
It's a highly biased solution.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, when things are moving, like in a game, you can get away with it pretty well, and it looks pretty awesome.
But you're still, like, on top of it, you've just, instead of saying, now I've simplified my problems because I'm adding ray tracing, you've actually added more problems.
Potentially, yes.
Yeah. You're having to choose. You're having to make more decisions and trade-offs.
Right. So that's completely fundamentally different from Lovina, which is basically like, we're just doing it the way you know how to do it.
Yeah, so we started Project Lovina with the idea, what if we always assume one of these new RTX cards was there? And these are the cards that have the...
Well, in the future, they will be.
They will be. It's only a matter of time.
Right.
And so... We, of course, plan for the future, and let's assume that that's always going to be there. So let's not try to have something that does it one way if the hardware is not there and another way if the hardware is there. Let's always assume it's there. And then the other thing is let's try to make the ray tracing as simple as possible. So kind of to Simeon's point about simplifying shaders, let's also do that for the shaders that will be used within Project Lovina.
Right.
And the reason is because this new ray tracing hardware doesn't do any shading. So that's still being computed in the standard way with CUDA on the GPU.
Right.
And
so these RTX cards, or the RTX cores, more specifically.
RT cores.
Mm-hmm. Those are only accelerating the ray tracing portion, not the shading portion.
Exactly. So the trace and traversal part, and then the whole shading part is up to the renderer.
Right.
And when we do this, we see a pretty good speed up, at least 5x over what would normally be standard CUDA. Mm-hmm. And CUDA itself is like at least 5 or 10 times faster than what would be on the CPU. So now we're talking some really good speeds.
So now we're like, if you like 10 times plus 5 times, we're talking 50 times faster than what you would see on a CPU just for the ray tracing portion.
No, the overall.
The overall.
Oh. The overall result.
Okay.
So the resulting frames per second. Mm. So that and now we're starting to get into real time speeds. Now we put in the real time denoising technology that's been out, and we created our own just for Lovina. Mm-hmm. And just with a few samples, it can now be silky smooth 24 frames a second.
Right.
Fully ray traced. And now we have a whole different trade-off, or we don't have the trade-offs that come with raster, because with raster, your performance goes down as your polygons go up.
Right.
And in ray tracing, that's not the case. So for a given resolution, ray tracing will be about the same speed, regardless of how many triangles you put in there, until you run out of memory.
Right.
So you no longer have to talk about optimizing your scene to run fast. A topic we didn't talk about. That's another fun thing about going into a game engine.
Right.
Is that you often have to decimate your model to actually make it fit into your target speed.
People specialize in, they're called low poly modelers specifically to deal with that budget.
Exactly, exactly. Well, with pure ray tracing, you don't have to do that.
Right.
So you can just throw your full design as is right in there, and that's not going to impact the speed.
Unless you run out of memory.
Right, but...
But your speed will never be impacted.
Exactly.
Right.
Which is beautiful. Then the other thing is I no longer have to worry about faking things, right? I no longer have to worry about faking reflections, even faking GI. That all can be there. Now, we have our own little budget that we work with for controlling things, especially GI, at those frame rates. But, you know, those are the trade-offs you can make. Mm-hmm. But it's always there for you. It's not like you have to suddenly do light baking.
Right.
Light baking is not required anymore.
Right. Well, I think that's interesting, and I think it's something that people really should be clear about when they're seeing a lot of these demos, because I've seen a ton of really great-looking demos, but I don't think people realize the amount of work that goes to make that happen. The rendering part is fast, but the work to get there...
Yeah, and that's what it comes down to, because we totally understand why designers want to get to real-time. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to get to VR, they want to get to real-time. But the road to get there was painful.
Right.
And so we're not just doing a pure ray tracing because we're a ray tracing company. We also think it makes, it solves the basic problem of getting into real time.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy. A scene that's been authored for V-Ray can simply be drag and dropped right into Project Lavina, and it works.
Right.
And suddenly you're tooling around in real time.
So yeah, so you've eliminated a massive amount of work by doing so.
A massive amount.
Okay. All right. Well, I know we got to get out of this conference room soon, so I want to quick summaries about some products and stuff we're doing. So you, Simeon, are obviously been working very closely with the Unreal stuff for a couple of years now almost, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Right? So you must be very excited about the fact that V-Ray for Unreal is happening right now, right? When it comes out, people will be able to use it. There's a lot of things that it can do. We mentioned about the translation of the scenes that come in and mm-hmm. the fact that it'll help your shaders. What are some of the other features that people will be able to use? You don't have to get into the little features, but like overall stuff that you can do with it.
Right. Well, yeah, people turn to V-Ray for Unreal, mm-hmm. Typically to get the V-Ray quality of lighting mm-hmm. and shading in Unreal as right. close as possible.
Right.
And the biggest accent in our development was to help this happen.
Right.
And to help it not only happen quality wise, but also to save artist time, as we discussed.
Right.
One of the important things that I feel will help our users is the fact that you can initiate a regular traditional V-Ray ray tracing rendering in Unreal from within Unreal. Which is interactive. And this is very important because once you transfer all the assets...
It's basically an IPR in a sense. Right?
Exactly,
right.
Yeah. And once you transfer all the assets in Unreal, you still need to start the process of doing the look development, the mm-hmm. lighting, and adjusting the shaders just specifically for this type of your project.
Right.
As we discussed, there are lots of decisions you need to make about different techniques which are faking the real ray tracing.
Right.
And light baking being the only solution that will give you quality lighting, mm-hmm.
So you can light bake with V-Ray
right.
inside of Unreal.
Yeah.
So that's really great because they know how to set up lighting to look right in V-Ray, mm-hmm. and then they can bake all that lighting in.
Yeah.
And there are other light baking solutions, but we're offering light baking with mm-hmm. V-Ray, right?
Where I'm getting at is that there is a light baking solution in Unreal. It's called Light Mass,
right.
And people have been using it, and it's been great for especially for gaming projects. But people turn to V-Ray because they know its capabilities when it comes to lighting and GI. Of course, our goal was to get that to these people.
Right.
But since quality takes time.
Yeah.
The light baking usually these are massive amounts of textures, mm-hmm. and the larger the textures are,
the longer
you need to render. Of
sure.
course. So this is pretty time-consuming process.
Right.
Of course, it's art. It's a machine time that
right.
that it occupies, but it's still quite long process. Mm-hmm. So the workflow that we suggest is use the interactive version of V-Ray mm-hmm. within Unreal. To use sort of a preview to get an idea what your light baking would be without committing to the light baking.
Ah, right. So right. you can adjust the lighting in V-Ray, look at it, and then bake it.
Exactly. You can do numerous scenarios, different lighting
Brilliant.
Situations.
Yeah.
You can even save versions of the level so that you can get different lighting scenarios baked later on.
Right.
And queue up this to the render farm. And render that with your already existing V-Ray nodes, because V-Ray for Unreal utilizes the universal render nodes.
Yeah.
Right.
So you can put it on the farm.
Yeah.
Great.
And you will get predictable result.
Great. Well, that's really great. Now, real quick, because we're this conference is about to take over, can you give me like a 1 minute idea of what Project Lavina, where that's going and what people can expect out of it? You mentioned like drop it into Lavina. So is Lavina going to become a standalone application?
Too early to tell, but I mean, our main intent with Project Lavina is to explore the possibilities of real-time ray tracing. Mm-hmm. And we know that it will eventually become a new render mode of V-Ray. And wherever V-Ray is, you should be able to go into Lavina mode, so to speak. And right now, in that world, that would mean that as you're seen as being working for V-Ray, you would suddenly just switch over and it would look more simple, but not be super fast. It would just work. Mm-hmm. And so we're testing that by using VR scenes inside of our little standalone framework.
Okay.
That said, we are getting a lot of interest in just getting access to Lavina no matter what.
Right.
So we'll see what happens.
Okay. Well, interesting. I think it's really great to think about these workflows. I think it changes the way that we think about rendering, because rendering now is no longer just throw as much quality as possible. It's about let's see how good I can make it look under that really fast budget. So
Exactly.
So, all right, guys, this has been great. Thanks so much for doing this. Well, it's great. I can't wait for people to find out more about this stuff. And we'll put all the information on our website and people can go check it out.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, guys.